Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hello, and welcome to the Preserving Optionality edition of Slate Money, your guide to the business and finance news of the week. The title, by the way, is a financial in-joke that... It's all to do with investment bankers, and investment bankers charge enormous fees for providing advice to companies. And the thing that they often do when they provide advice to companies is they, you know, cash their enormous check, and then they say, I think what you should do is preserve optionality, which is basically a very fancy way of saying do nothing at all.
Yes.
And so if you want to get paid lots of money for advising people to do absolutely nothing, you have to learn this phrase, preserve optionality. It comes in surprisingly handy in many different contexts. I am Felix Salmon of Fusion. I am joined with the core Slate Money team. No last minute swap out.
So
here.
Felix, I wanted to call this episode the Getting the Band Back Together episode.
I think exactly. I can't remember the last time we were all in the Slate studios together. It feels cozy.
It is.
It feels cozy. Kathy O'Neill.
Yeah.
You have a book coming out.
It's really exciting. It's 4 days from now. I'm just about to vomit with excitement.
I feel like next week.
That's the best kind of excitement. The part that gives you like queasy, bileless feeling in your stomach.
I alternate between like nausea and ecstasy. Yeah.
So next week, I think we're going to just devote the entire episode to Kathy's book.
That's if Jordan can actually find time to read it.
I'm going to read the book. Oh, have I been introduced? No, this is how I'm being introduced. I'm going to read the book.
I'm looking forward to it.
But what is the book? We need the official plug.
It's called Weapons of Math Destruction.
And you will hear all about it next week. And in case you hadn't noticed, there's a guy who's bad at reading books in the studio with us too, Mr. Jordan Weissman.
I is good at read. I can read.
He Jordan likes to read things on the internet which are short. If you give him something like which is bound, it starts becoming.
It's just that Jordan tricky. Is like it's one tough. Of those like I'll wait till it's urgent type of people.
That's basically my life.
We are gonna talk this week about shopping malls and a chain called Aeropostale, because I feel like we haven't done much tween fashion of late.
Felix is wearing their summer line right
much
now.
Much needed gap.
We are going to talk about the way in which it's actually possible to get more than half of your computer science class to be women.
Amazing.
Believe it or not. But, and this is the big financial news of the week, I think. This is my favorite story of the week. We are going to start, Jordan, talking about tax havens and Ireland and Apple.
Yes.
So what is going on here?
So, yeah, the EU's competition regulators, basically their antitrust regulators, came down with a ruling this week saying that Apple... it needs to pay 13 billion euros in back taxes to Ireland. And the weird thing about this story is that Ireland isn't particularly happy about this. They don't really want those 13 billion euros in back taxes.
Depending on who you talk to. This is the wonderful thing. So the Irish have made quite a cottage industry about in attracting companies like Apple with very low by dangling the carrot of very low tax rates in front of them. But now they're faced with this $14 billion windfall.
Yes.
They're like, really? I mean, this is a lot of money to just turn our nose up at.
So the idea is they want the money. I mean, they're still not really... Okay, individuals in Ireland.
Yeah.
And some of the government.
Some, like the Sinn Féin people were like...
The cabinet is split on this.
Yeah.
But the people who promised Apple the low tax rate, doing the honorable thing and saying, no, we promised them a low tax rate. We have to be true to our promise.
There is a great quote where it's so Irish. One of the ministers says, we can't do this because it's going to give us a horrible reputation and companies are going to be mad at us and we're going to be this place that does funny business with taxes and we'll be, quote, eating the seed potatoes.
So Irish. As an Irish person, I'm like, wow, that's Irish. But, I mean, all I meant to say is like, they want the money, but they also are afraid of what the consequences of taking the money are.
Yeah.
Right?
So, well.
Well, but let's go back first and
talk about the details.
Talk about like what this ruling is, because it's fascinating. This is basically the EU Competition Commission, as you say, doing its job and saying, we want a level playing field within Europe. And what you can't do is basically allow companies to pay 0.005% of their revenue in taxes, because that means that you're just going to have this race to the bottom among companies just going to the lowest tax jurisdiction country rather than, you know, going to where the labor is best or anything like that. So they're saying it's unfair competition between Ireland and the rest of Europe rather than it's illegal taxation. The actual taxation was perfectly legal.
Well, I think there are two levels of what's kind of going on in Ireland, and it helps to have some context, right? So there's like normal tax avoidance, like everyday tax avoidance, where this is what basically every company that is capable of doing it does, where you try to book your profits in a country where it just has a very low tax rate, right? Ireland has a 12.5% corporate tax rate. That's pretty low.
It's pretty low.
And so if you're a tech company, the name of the game is figuring out a way that you can theoretically book your profits in Ireland. Maybe one way you do that is you hand over your intellectual property to an Irish subsidiary. And then when you make money off that intellectual property, it gets booked in Ireland at a low rate.
Or the way that Apple did it is they created this company called Apple Sales International, which technically was the company which sold basically every Apple product sold, not only in Europe, but all throughout the Middle East and North Africa. And
okay.
But 12.5 is a lot bigger than...
Well, so that's what we're getting to.
0.005.
So it's like you have this low tax rate, right? So that's normal tax avoidance. That's and the EU isn't trying to regulate that. They're saying it's fine if you have a very low tax rate. But then there's this second level that was going on with Ireland. And basically, what this company, Apple Sales International, the subsidiary was doing, was it was booking all these profits. But then... And it was booking all the profits for Apple sales in Europe. It's a lot of money. And then it was saying, well, actually, those profits belong to something called our head office. And our head office doesn't actually exist anywhere. It's not in a country. It's just sort of an on-paper air office. It's an office in our imagination. And that head office doesn't have to pay Ireland's tax rate. And so...
Okay, so let's be clear about it. It wasn't just... the fact that head office was a kind of imaginary thing.
Yeah.
The stated reason why it didn't need to pay Ireland's tax rate was not that it was resident in the cloud or anything like that. The stated reason was that ultimately Apple is an American company which pays American taxes, and Apple is this American company owns all of the intellectual property. And as Tim Cook said in his very angry letter about this, we believe that taxes should be paid where the value was created, and quite obviously the value was created in the US and not in Ireland, so we shouldn't be paying the taxes in Ireland.
So one way to describe this head office was sort of a way station for this money that is theoretically going to go back to the US maybe one day.
And this is the bit which really kind of annoys me, which is that what happened in the wake of this ruling is that you got a bunch of people, including Jack Lew, the Treasury Secretary, Chuck Schumer, and, you know, a bunch of people who have been quite keen to bash Apple for keeping all of its profits offshore and not paying US taxes, complain about this ruling, saying that it deprives the US of its natural tax base. And Tim Cook is saying the same thing. He's like, no, this tax should be paid in the US.
Which
this
they
tax
obviously
should not be paid in Ireland. And the thing which you just want to scream at all of them was, well, yes, it probably should be paid in the US, but you haven't been paying it in the US. You haven't been repatriating it to pay it in the US. And it's a bit late now to change your mind. Okay, this is the thing
guys, I haven't said anything yet.
Okay,
by the way, I have like 85 comments to make.
All right.
So I agree with you, Felix. It seems extremely hypocritical of the United States because we've been doing all these things, and we've talked about them on the show before, to try to avoid these tax inversions. But now we're like, oh, If the European Commission is trying to like avoid that kind of tax, unfair tax competition between countries, then that's not okay because somehow that's our money.
Yeah.
I'd understand that. I guess, but going back to the very beginning for a second,
yeah.
Does the European Commission actually have jurisdiction? Can they do this?
So yeah, that's what's interesting here. I mean, Europe doesn't have one umbrella tax regulator, but it does have this it does have an antitrust body, right? And they're basically saying that this deal that that Apple got, this tax ruling Apple got, saying yeah, this head office move is kosher, was an illegal subsidy. And typically, the idea of stopping subsidies is you're supposed to not, you know, give money to your like your big national car company or something like that. You're not supposed to subsidize.
You're not supposed to pick and choose.
Yeah, you're not supposed to, you know. But this time, instead, what they're saying is, well, you're subsidizing these multinationals essentially, and that's unfair too because other companies that don't get that subsidy aren't playing on an even field. You're seeing sort of similar stuff happening with companies like Starbucks and McDonald's and with things they do in Luxembourg. And there are actually thousands of smaller versions of these deals all across Europe. And that's what has a lot of people kind of worried is that, you know, Apple is the biggest version of this and its deal is a little bit different than some of the other ones. But there's the sense that, okay, Europe's going to try and crack down on these super sweetheart deals. The thing you have to remember is they're not cracking down on just the super low tax rates that encourage a lot of the garden variety tax avoidance that makes the
right,
you know, corporate
the first
world
kind
go around.
About, yeah.
This is they are only dealing with one sort of extreme layer, one extreme version of this.
The angle which I'm fascinated by here, though, yeah. is the unbelievable amount of anger that you're getting not only from US politicians, but also from Apple. Because to read Tim Cook's letter and to read his interviews on, you know, Irish television and that kind of thing, you would believe that Apple has been just dealt a body blow by the Europeans. And
it's got 260 billion
so here's
cash
the thing,
sitting
like,
around.
Well, no, so it's much weirder than that. The first thing is that Apple changed its entire structure in 2015, so nothing changes going forwards or nothing. This doesn't affect Apple's taxation right now at all. Mm-hmm. The other thing, which is I don't think anyone's really picked up on and is just astonishing to me, is that this $14 billion ruling from the EU saying, oi, Apple, you need to pay the Irish government $14 billion in back taxes. How much do you think, Kathy, that raises Apple's total tax liability?
I was just thinking, like, it's about 7% of the amount of money they have just literally lying around,
Well, the answer is that it raises Apple's total tax liability by zero.
What?
By absolutely zero. That because there's a dual taxation treaty between the US and Ireland, if Apple pays those taxes in Ireland, it does not need to pay those taxes in the US. Now, it wasn't paying those taxes in the US either. Anyway, but right now, on Apple's balance sheet, it has a $24 billion tax liability
to the US. So they should be completely neutral to it.
It is completely neutral to Apple's balance sheet.
I mean,
100% neutral. It does not affect Apple's balance sheet at all.
Yeah, it does circle back, though, to the fact of the matter that they were never planning to repatriate this money. And I think they were.
And I think this is the real reason why Tim Cook is angry, is that when you have $24 billion that you owe the U.S. and you're not paying the U.S., that is leverage. He had leverage over the U.S. and he was making noises that he was going to start repatriating these things and start paying a lot more tax in the U.S. And he was sort of in quiet negotiations with the Americans about starting to pay all of these billions of dollars in taxes that they haven't been paying until now. And if Ireland goes and snaffles all of that money, then he loses that carrot in negotiations with the U.S.
That's
the main thing that he's losing here.
The leverage is for the tax holiday.
Wait, when you say negotiations, are you talking? Yeah, wait, are you talking about a temporary repatriation tax holiday? Is that what negotiations?
That's my guess.
Who knows? It could just be like some other weird thing. Maybe he just wants the Justice Department to stop trying to break into iPhones. There's any number of things he could be asking for.
Here's why the U.S. should welcome this. The U.S. should welcome this because if Apple gets screwed by European taxes, even after the fact, then fewer people fewer companies will pick up and move to Ireland in order to avoid taxes. Because they're like, I don't understand what's going to happen in the future, so I'll just stay here in the United States.
Isn't that the thing that we want as Americans?
The
reason I disagree with that is because you're still not addressing the fundamental issue with it's still a really good deal to be in Ireland with that 12.5% tax rate. What they're saying is Apple can't get an even better deal than that. They can still, it's still worth most companies' time to go and do the legal footwork you need to pay, you know,
it makes it less attractive.
Yeah, it does make it less attractive. But I don't think the margin is enough to really make or break many decisions.
The other thing I want to mention, which I know Felix is going to enjoy, is an analogy to the EpiPen situation. It's like, here's what Apple is really doing, and like that imaginary thing that you were talking about, that imaginary home something.
The way station.
Right. So Apple is basically like hiding behind having sort of patent protection going on in the United States, and by the way, political protection, obviously, in the United States, but it's getting its tax rates for Ireland.
Yeah.
Similar to the way that Mylan, which is, you know, makes the EpiPen, gets patent protection from the US, but it's actually tax base is in the Netherlands. Like these multinational corporations are picking and choosing what they want from each country. I mean, it's
That's
like
a really good point.
If I wanted the maternity leave in Scandinavia, but I wanted to have like to be an entrepreneur in New York City. Like I can't do that as an individual. I have to choose a country to live in, but these multinationals get to literally get the best of each world.
Okay, so Kathy, since you've gone and done it,
I did it.
You've gone and brought up that word EpiPen.
I know you wanted to talk about that.
So I'm now
on the spur of the moment, unilaterally expanding this podcast from three topics to three and a half.
All right.
Because we did get a bit of feedback on last week's
episode.
Someone
referring to it as a drug as opposed to a
device. When we talked about EpiPen, and we talked about lots of interesting things about EpiPen, but there is one big thing about EpiPen which we didn't talk about, and I think it's just, since we have Kathy here and she loves to talk about EpiPen.
I do.
The one thing which we should just very briefly talk about is this thing, which is that yes, the EpiPen is a $600 device, but what you are paying for is not the drug. What you are paying for is the device.
Yeah.
The drug is out of patent, out of copyright. You can buy it actually in any drugstore for like $1.50, and you can, you know, if you go into an anaphylactic shock and you have the drug which you picked up at the drugstore, you can, you know, put it into a syringe, inject it in yourself, and it does exactly the same thing that an EpiPen would do. The only thing, the amazing thing is that Mylan has managed to patent a delivery device, not even a drug, and that somehow the FDA has managed to give Mylan a monopoly on epinephrine, delivery devices, rather than on the drug itself, and that every time someone else tries to come out into the market with a new delivery device, somehow they get shot down.
Well, I wouldn't say every time. The device itself is off patent. There was one particularly important instance. Teva Pharmaceuticals was going to come out with a generic EpiPen, essentially, and then, for whatever reason, it's not clear, their device didn't work well enough, and the FDA said no dice, and they can retry in 2017, basically.
I thought the stated reason was that people are going to try to use this thing exactly the same way as you would an EpiPen, and in fact, you need to use it a slightly different way, and people might get confused and get it wrong because they're used to EpiPens.
I haven't read the FDA's...
By the way, they had to make it slightly different from the EpiPen, or else it would break patent. Yep. This whole thing is a disgusting mess, and you know, everyone's going to be like heaving a sigh of relief when the EpiPen like device finally leaves patent, because like it's something that we all need. Like we shouldn't all be trained in using syringes.
Well,
right? That's the point.
The device itself is, I'm pretty sure, off patent.
Jordan's right. I don't think the device is patented. I think that just what's happening is that Mylan is getting astonishingly lucky, you might say, or else it just has extremely good lobbyists at the FDA, in that whenever anyone tries to bring a competitor to the market, the FDA says, oh, not good enough.
Oh, okay.
And in fact, one of the reasons why Mylan raised the price so much in the first place was precisely because they expected all of these competitors to be coming around the corner. So they're like, we're going to try and get as much money as we can out of this market before this whole market dries up. And then amazingly, wonderfully for them, Like, the market hasn't dried up because none of these competitors have been allowed. And so there is, underneath everything, this isn't really about drug patenting. It's not really about drugs at all. There does seem to be a story about the FDA's kind of cravenness and inability to allow new technology into the drug
pipeline.
World.
Yeah, I mean,
one upside is that all the commotion about what happened with the EpiPen will probably make them a little bit more likely to approve the next generic that comes out. Aside from,
we Mylan's, keep on thinking the FDA is going to improve overnight because of all these horrible things.
Well,
the FDA never does anything overnight. Anyway, that we only have half a segment for EpiPen, so we're going to end EpiPen there.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
And now, Kathy.
Yeah.
You have some good news for us.
I do. I'm going to be upbeat today, guys. Is that okay with everyone?
Yeah.
So here's the bad news. The bad news is the undergraduates who are getting degrees in computer science in the United States are almost all men. They're like, there's like 16, maybe 18% women. And it's been really, really flat for the last few decades. I mean, in fact, it's gone down a little bit and then it went up a little bit, but it's really quite flat. It's always been less than 20%. So the question is, why is that?
Why is that, Kathy?
Well, you know, there's a bunch of different theories. And one of the newest theories is that it's just because they're teaching it badly.
The universities,
they're teaching poorly.
And then somehow the women who are applying or not applying for computer science degrees can sense that on their tour of campus. And they kind of can smell the bad teaching. And so they don't even apply for the program to begin with.
Well, I mean, possibly. But I mean, that's actually, you know, let me put it this way. Like, there's 49% of the MIT undergraduates are now women. It's not like that women aren't going to technical universities, right? It's just that they're avoiding the computer science major. And so the question, and Harvey Mudd was in the news this week.
Are you finally getting to the good news?
I am. The good news is great. It's really, really exciting. I have to tell you, this is something that's been bothering me my entire life as a math nerd woman, because it's the same situation in math. And I still, anyway, here's the good news. Harvey Mudd, which had less than 10%, like lower than the national average in 2007, now has 55% female computer science majors. They've like absolutely turned the ship around, and they are super friendly to women. And those women are going on to getting really good technology jobs.
So tell us, what does a female-friendly computer science department look like?
Okay. So what they've done is they've hired a lot more women throughout the entire university. The president is a woman. That might help. I'm not sure what exactly helps. I'm going to tell you what they've done, what they've talked about. I think the most important thing probably is the way they start the undergraduate curriculum. They have a required programming course. This is Harvey Mudd. It's very nerdy.
So this is for every single undergraduate in the entire university to take a programming course.
Like, Harvey Mudd is like the MIT of the Claremont colleges, you know, down in Southern California. It's not Caltech, but it's, you know, it's like that. What they do is they have...
So it's not a liberal arts college?
Not at all.
No, they do very well on salary surveys because they have so many engineering grads.
They're basically an engineering school.
Yeah.
So what they've done is they've required everyone to take a computer class, but not just any computer class. It's a Python class. Python is my favorite language. It's a very, very friendly language. It's almost like pseudocode. If you read it, it's like very friendly. And they have three tracks. And I think this is the most important aspect of it. Three tracks. So you get to choose which track to go into. But the most important one is the one that doesn't require any prior computer science. And you can be a CS major even if you start there. So the reason I mentioned this as important is that I've been talking to this group at Columbia called Color Code, which is like a group of undergrad CS majors who are concerned that the computer science major at Columbia, is sort of unfairly discriminates against minorities and women. I live near Columbia, so I don't want to point it out as like the worst performing in any sense of the word. But they do things in the computer science major at Columbia that are really not helpful for people. And the number one complaint is that, you know, it's a weeder course. Like the first undergraduate CS major course is a weeder course that very much appeals to people who've already been programming for 10 years.
When you say a weeder course, what you mean is a lot of people take it and most people don't even finish it.
It sounds like the equivalent of organic chemistry or something to weed out pre-med majors.
So
kind of
the quote I was told by
first of all, can you just tell me what is a weeder course?
But the quote I was told was the very first day, the professor, who's actually a nice guy, said to the class, half of y'all won't make it.
Yeah.
Literally, like, we are intending to get rid of half of you. Yeah. The point is, if you say that to people, the people that feel like they're the least prepared are going to be like, they have a sign on their face, like, I will not succeed. And it really happens.
And so what happens to those people who drop out of the class? They just wind up with a second-rate, pure mathematics degree.
Not necessarily. So there's actually been some research on this and what happens to the women and minorities who get weeded out. And a lot of them go into like liberal arts and just easier majors. A lot of them get discouraged from the idea of doing science at all because they are a little bit more sensitive to failure than dudes.
Absolutely a sensitivity to failure. And it's not just men, women that are sensitive to failure. Some men are too. But the point is that it's statistically much harsher for the people who haven't had a lot of success already. Yeah. So there is one class at Columbia, as I understand it, that you can take if you have no experience in computer science, but you can't then go on to be a computer science major because there's just not enough time. So it's... All I'm saying is a design. There's a designed curriculum. It happens at Harvey Mudd. They're expanding it to other colleges that really works. Now, the bad news about this new design is that it's expensive. It takes more resources. And I know people at MIT doing this as well in mathematics and statistics. They flip the classroom. They have more teachers. They have group work. It's very interactive. It takes more resources. So that's going to be a problem for places that aren't, small, really, really expensive schools. Like Harvey Mudd costs $72,000 $72,000 a year.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. And MIT is expensive too. So
you probably make it back. I mean, they probably also give some decent financial aid. I mean, Harvey Mudd grads make bank. That's one thing.
Yeah, but $72,000 a year for 4 years is, I believe the technical term is a shit ton of money.
That's true. I don't think many people, I would assume a good percentage of people are not actually paying that sticker price. But nonetheless, it is expensive.
When I say $72,000, I should mention that that's like tuition plus everything else, like living there.
Still a lot of money.
It's a lot of money.
I do think...
72 is the one I worry about as a parent.
I do wonder, though, like what the marginal cost to tuition overall, how bad that could really be for implementing something like this in what is one of the most essential majors for any engineering
schools.
Here's
the thing, not to rag on Columbia too much, but like the thing about Columbia is that it's their most popular major. And NYU
is it really now?
Yes.
I didn't realize that.
And NYU is like one of the top three majors. And
Stanford is definitely the top.
Absolutely. Yeah. And Stanford, by the way, is doing quite well with women too. They have 30% women. I mean, that's better than average. So they have all these people that want to be CS majors and you're weeding them out. Like, why? You'd think that they would, and this is like something I complain about a lot, but if you think if the academic world responded like a business responded.
They would go, oh my God, we have all of this demand. We should create more computer science graduates.
Exactly. Why not? Why don't we expand the computer science department so that it has all kinds of different.
It's not like teaching computer science is vastly more expensive than teaching anything else.
No, that's true. And actually, I want to jump on this too, just elaborating on why it makes no sense. Because the idea of a weeder course really very much comes from pre-med. I mean, that's a huge part part of it. And it makes sense in pre-med because there are only so many spots in medical schools. Not everyone who finishes pre-med will even get accepted.
Exactly.
So you need to weed kids out of that, because otherwise you're just going to have a lot of people who are suddenly faced with, or you don't have to, but it, at least there's a rationale. Computer science, there is, you know, there is no surplus of computer science grads from top universities right now.
Right.
If you can produce more of those, that's good for everybody.
Natural limit to the number of CS majors we want to see.
Yes. So all you schools out there teaching computer science, which is probably every school out there, I mean, realistically, stop dissuading people, and especially women, from studying computer science, and don't weed people out. And the more computer science graduates that America has, the better we will be at making America great again.
The better we will be at...
Wow.
Okay.
Your pet is one of a kind, and so is their journey. While every playful moment is a memory in the making, sometimes cats and dogs are a little too good at getting into trouble. That's why you should check out ASPCA Pet Health Insurance. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program offers customizable accident and illness plans, making it easier for pet parents like you to help your pet get the care they may need. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program has been around for over 18 years, and they've helped more than 600,000 pets during that time. They allow you to customize your plan, helping ensure your pet's plan is as unique as they are. Because vet bills can really add up, especially when you're least expecting it. It's simple. Use their app to submit a claim, and you'll receive reimbursement for eligible vet bills directly into your bank account. To explore coverage, visit aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. That's aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. Again, that's aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. This is a paid advertisement. Insurance is underwritten by either Independence American Insurance Company or United States Fire Insurance Company, and produced by PTZ Insurance Agency Limited. The ASPCA is not an insurer and is not engaged in the business of insurance.
It's fashion time here on Slate Money.
It's always fashion time with you, Felix.
It's always fashion time with me. I'm literally wearing my father-in-law's shirt right now.
It's nice.
So
it's very tiki bar. There's like some multicolored palm fronds in blue, purple, and green. There's a lot going on here.
I did not buy it at a shopping mall. And in this, I am...
Do shopping malls still exist?
This is a very good question. Okay, it turns out that shopping malls do still exist. But, you know, the modern people... We try not to use the M word on this show. The snake people, they have more or less given up on going to shopping malls because it's a miserable experience. Who wants to, you know, walk around an antiseptic, air-conditioned bunch of shops for hours on end? I've never understood the appeal of this, but now it turns out there's a whole generation of Americans who don't understand the appeal of this, and what they're doing is they're not going to the mall.
I used to have this thing when I went to malls, because that was what people did when I was a teenager, where like if like 20 minutes in, I had some kind of like feeling of, I called it the mall coma. Like I couldn't breathe, I couldn't think. I just ended up at Friendly's eating like peppermint stick ice cream.
I used to spend a ton of time at malls when I was a kid. I'd go to the arcades, and anyway, this is tangential to, I just say there is a certain appeal to just being inundated with retail. And
now people just go on the internet. Yeah. Like,
so, also, if you have to have a car to get places, it's a central meeting place where everyone can just kind of hang out and do whatever. There's a logic to it. But now it's lost its appeal. And
it has lost its appeal partly because, you know, the kids these days are less likely to have cars. The result of this is that a bunch of companies which were built on having hundreds or in some cases over 1,000 different outlets in malls across the country are doing quite badly. This company called Wet Seal went bust. This company called Pacific Sunwear went bust. And then this company called Aeropostal went bust.
Is anyone crying for that? Any of
them? No, really no one is crying. Like, I feel like the bankruptcy of Aeropostal is probably bad for the equity holders of Aeropostal.
Yeah,
but,
okay.
You know, you can, I'm sure they'll be fine in the grand scheme of things. So, what's interesting to me about this story is that there was a bankruptcy auction for the assets of Aeropostale, and it was won with a bid of $243.3 million by a consortium which is led by, get this, Simon Property Group and General Growth, which are the two biggest mall operators, basically. So what happened is that these mall operators looked at Aeropostale and said, you have 800 stores open. We're going to buy you. We're going to actually keep open, I think, 229 of those stores, which is a good outcome, as well as doing the e-commerce and the brand licensing and all of that kind of stuff. And those 229 stores are going to keep on paying rent. And because they're in the mall, they're going to attract people who want to shop at Aeropostale. And they get a bunch of benefit from having those stores open, which is above and beyond what any other owner of Aeropostale could have. And so what you have is the landlord basically buying the business in order to keep the business open. And I find that a fascinating story.
Isn't that just sad?
Yeah, I was going to say, that's how desperate they are. The entire point of operating a mall is that you do not have to own the stores. That is why you started a mall.
It's like a free market opening on tenants. Yeah.
Okay, but now, because I'm Felix Salmon, I'm going to tie this into sovereign debt.
I thought we were going to talk about optionality, but let's hear about Argentina. Okay, let's do it.
So Aeropostale in this metaphor is Argentina.
Okay.
So you will remember, vividly as I do, the sovereign debt crisis of 1998. And what happened was that Russia defaulted on its debt. There was a massive repercussion around the world. Markets crashed in every single market around the world for weeks and weeks. It was devastating. Spreads on emerging market debt around the world gapped out. And this is on a relatively small default of not very many, just domestic bonds, not even the international bonds, by Russia in 98. And then what happened a few years later in 2002 is that Argentina had a much, much larger default on its debt. It was like over $100 billion. It was enormous. And Argentina was much more connected to Wall Street and to the markets and to Latin America and to the, you know, emerging markets than Russia ever was. It had a much bigger GDP and so on and so forth. And the repercussions of the Argentine default were basically bupkis. Nothing happened. There was no crash. There was no contagion. I mean, there was a little bit of contagion before the default in Brazil, but then after the default, nothing happened.
So who are the landlords here? Lost.
The metaphor, which I'm painfully drawing here, is that, well, Argentina was described as the slowest train crash in history. Mm-hmm. Like, everyone saw it coming. Mm-hmm. What I'm trying to say here is that slow-moving train crashes are much less harmful.
Collateral damage.
What I'm saying is that what Simon Property and General Growth, they're not in Aeropostale for the long haul. They're not buying the equity because they want to own it in 50 years and they think it's some wonderful, great long-term investment. What they're doing is they're softening the blow. They're putting foam on the runway.
I was going to say foam on the runway.
Foam on the runway. And what they're doing is they're saying, we can keep these stores open until the point at which we can find a better tenant to take over that store. And then we can just, you know, close down that store, replace it with a better tenant, rather than just having an empty store and have to scramble around to try and find a tenant for the empty store.
Or until, like, malls die officially.
Until malls die officially. Exactly. So they have... It makes them better in the short term, and it makes their cash flow a little bit more certain. They get to continue, you know, getting the rents, and they slow down the train crash. And if you slow down the train crash, that's good not only for the mall operators, but it's actually good for all the people who work at Aeropostale as well.
You know, this also makes me think about this issue of keeping storefronts full, right? That being necessary, like just avoiding blight in a mall. You know, it makes me think that there's probably some contagion amongst all these companies that rely on mall sales, right? Like if one goes out of business and the storefronts start going empty, like, Strawberry down the block, or like Forever 21 a few doors down is also going to be a hot topic, is going to be in trouble. And so I wonder if there's like an index that you could short then of all these mall companies. As one goes, the others are going to fall.
The Cinnabon Index.
Yeah. Cinnabon would totally be on there.
Totally. Cinnabon is the nexus, man. People get addicted to Cinnabons, and that's why they go to the mall. I lied when I said I didn't know what malls are for.
So anyway, if you have ever been to a mall, do write to us at slatemoney@slate.com because we have no idea what we're talking about.
Apple Card is the perfect cash back rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
I feel that it's time for a numbers round because we need to, you know, we've already squeezed 3.5 topics
into
this thing.
Yeah, it's time. Let's do it.
Okay, so Jordan, what's your number?
You're looking at me like you're expecting a number.
I am expecting a number, not Jordan. Yeah, I hope you have a number.
Yeah, so my number is 68, which is the percentage of Americans who at some point in their lives won't pay any federal income taxes. There is a, you know, there's the famous 47% number, right? During the 2012, we all learned there were 47% of Americans who don't pay federal income taxes. And those were the takers, and Paul Ryan and Mitt Romney were running for the makers. The thing about those sorts of stats, and it's useful to think about this with like poverty statistics too, anything that tells you about how many rich or poor people are in this country, is that they don't really give you the full picture because people's incomes change over their lifetime. Some people are going to be poor forever. Some people will be poor for a month. People go in and out of it. Same with this tax status. It turns out that over the course of lifetimes, more than 2/3 of Americans will at some point be among the quote takers.
Well, does that include their kids.
Yeah. Does this include like when you're in college?
Yeah. I mean, it's in lifetime at some point. I have to double check about.
I mean, no child pays taxes. So
yeah,
it's
well, no, these
be,
are these
and,
are,
and
yeah,
college
these are
students tend not to pay taxes. And when you're in jail, you don't pay taxes. And there's lots of reasons why. When you're retired,
let's just say when you otherwise might be paying taxes.
Yeah,
2/3 of the.
But it is true that these things are highly variable. And but you know, the other thing is that you can afford to not pay taxes if you have wealth. Like if you have a wealth cushion and you have a year of very low income, you're like, okay, I'll just spend down my wealth. It's less harmful to you than if you don't have any wealth. So, just because you're not paying taxes doesn't mean you're poor necessarily.
That is true too.
Just ask Donald Trump.
Yes.
Sorry, we're not allowed to use that word.
I broke my rule. If I had done that, I'd be getting.
Jordan,
did you notice that I broke that rule? Last time.
Did you?
Oh, you were away. You didn't listen.
Yeah, I'd be getting reamed right now anyway.
So. Okay. So I have a number which is a birthday number. I would like to take this opportunity to wish a happy 40th birthday to Vanguard.
Oh.
They're 40 years old this week, and happy birthday, Vanguard. And there was this attempt to try and work out how much money Vanguard had saved people over the years. And so that's my number. It's $515 billion.
On fees.
Which is made up of $175 billion in fees. That is, the Vanguard fees are much lower than you would otherwise have paid. So that savings is about $175 billion. And then there's another $140 billion in trading costs because Vanguard doesn't trade as often as most other
They're passive investing.
Places you can put your money.
Isn't it kind of Marxist of you to talk about?
I'm totally Marxist on this. And then they've added on another $200 billion in lower fees from everyone else because they're having to compete with Vanguard. And that adds up to $515 billion. And then, of course, you can sort of extrapolate it forwards and say that in a few years' time, it's probably going to reach a trillion. Vanguard has saved Americans an absolutely astonishing amount of money. And you can quibble with whether that's actually true, because it does look like Wall Street and the buy side seems to be doing quite okay for itself these days, and that, you know, it's not exactly in the poorhouse, but it is clearly a force for good in the world. So happy birthday, Vanguard.
All right. My number is 61. It's a really good number. As I said, I was going to be positive today. In the United States, in the past 25 years, the teen birth rate has declined by 61% nationwide. Mm-hmm. That's astounding and wonderful.
And no one knows why.
Everybody knows why. Yeah. The answer is they're having just as much sex, God bless their hearts, but they're using contraception.
Yep.
Thank you. Thank you, contraception people.
Yeah, this used to be more of a debate. There were like people saying, oh, it's like a cultural thing, but there were some studies recently that finally are just like, no, it's contraception.
Can I just add in like a another number.
Yeah. Why not have another, an extra, but if we can have 3.5 segments, we can have 3.5
Here's
numbers.
My half
well.
Number.
What's your
zero,
half
zero?
That counts as a half number.
How much taxes there are on tampons and maxi pads in New York State now.
Woohoo!
Officially this week. Yes.
You did it.
Yes. We can so write in to slatemoney@slate.com and say thank you, Kathy, for the fact that I no longer need to pay tax
and
on
if you
my
do,
tampons in New York State.
If you do get charged taxes, please take a picture of your bill.
Email
and hashtag tweet the receipt.
That too.
What's the hashtag?
Hashtag tweet the receipt.
Tweet the receipt. Okay.
Kathy O'Neill, change maker.
Yes.
Okay. So on which happy note, we will wrap up this edition of Slate Money. We will come back next week talking all about weapons of mass destruction, because I can attest that Kathy has written a fantastic book. Jordan may or may not be able to have an opinion on the book.
The book will have been read by me by right. the time we record.
So yeah, it just falls to me to thank Zach Dinerstein for producing this show, and Steve Lichtai and Andy Bowers, the executive producers, and to point you to itunes.com/panoply, where you can find all of the Panoply podcasts. And we will talk to you next week on Slate Money.